Mind-changing radio.
I don't say that dogs are unique because they form strong emotional bonds with people, but what I do say is that dogs are unique in the intensity and drive and readiness and desire to form those emotional bonds.
Is there a way to scientifically measure our dog's love for us? And does it really matter? My next guest says emphatically yes. Dr. Clive Wynn is a behavioral scientist doing extensive research on the love between dogs and humans and why it matters. My next guest, Dr. Clive Wynn, author of Dog is Love on Self Talk Radio Show, brought to you by Pure Energy Apothecary, now offering hand sanitizers and lotions in scented and unscented. Get yours at pureenergybody.com. Welcome to the show, Doctor. Appreciate having you on.
Sarah, thank you so much for inviting me. It's great to be with you.
You know, and in these days when things are a little on the dark side, to say the least, there's nothing like the love of a dog when you come home from a pretty tough day, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Keep us from all from going crazy, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What propelled you to study dogs in love with their owners?
Well, Sarah, I've always loved dogs. Ever since I was a little kid, I had a dog, and it's such an important part of my growing up. But for a long time, I was kind of out in the doggy wilderness. I studied psychology, animal behavior psychology, and people who study that kind of thing, they tend to study animals that are easy to keep in small pens in a laboratory. And so I had a career, you know. I was a successful animal psychologist. I studied marsupials in Australia, pigeons in the United States. But I came to a point where I had a kind of a mid-career, midlife crisis where I just felt, Sarah, that working with the animals I worked with, even though it was intellectually stimulating, it wasn't emotionally satisfying. Mm. And so I started thinking, well, is there an animal that I could study that would bring me greater emotional satisfaction? And I feel kind of stupid that it actually took me over a year to figure out that the animal I needed to be studying was dogs. Because there's no animal that creates a stronger emotional bond with people than dogs. And yet understanding how that's possible and the forms that that takes, I mean, that's a massive project, and scientists have tended to shy away from it. So about 15 years ago now, I finally realized what my life's true purpose was, and that was to understand and strive to improve the life that dogs and people lead together.
Now, I'm already seeing it. I'm seeing someone who's a cat fan throwing her iPhone across the room saying, "No, it's cats, it's cats." What do you say to people who feel an intimate bond with cats and the emotional love from them?
So I don't for a moment deny that people, I mean, I have had cats in my life. I mean, we have a cat now, but the cat we have now doesn't have much of an emotional bond, at least with me. But I know, I mean, people have emotional bonds with all sorts of different pet animals, and it's not impossible to form strong emotional connections to wild animal species if you get to know them early enough in life. So I don't say that dogs are unique because they form strong emotional bonds with people. But what I do say is that dogs are unique in the intensity and drive and readiness and desire to form those emotional bonds. I'm sure that even people who love cats, and there's nothing wrong with loving cats, even those people notice that it's easier for a dog to fall in love with you. Indeed, that's what a lot of cat people love about their cats, that they feel special because the cat chose them, because they notice that cats are not as, we could say, emotionally promiscuous as dogs. Dogs are, in general, much more driven to form emotional connections with people. So I think that's where dogs truly stand out, not because they're the only animals that form emotional bonds with people. Hey, this morning I was talking, one of my students is a great fan of reptiles. He has a pet lizard, you know, to each his own, okay?
but you know, you just can't really scruff up a lizard. You know, who's a good boy? Who's a good boy?
Who's a good lizard? Yeah, I was asking, what kind of things do you say to your lizard in those loving moments? I don't know.
Oh, gosh. Yes. Now, and I'm wondering, too, with dogs, is it like a genetic propensity to be so affectionate?
Well, right, Sarah. You asked this, for a biological scientist, you asked the million-dollar question. Because if there's something that a particular species or subspecies of animals has that makes them as a species special, It has to be written in their genetic material. That's the blueprint, right? That's the code. It has to be written in there somehow, somewhere. But generally speaking, it's very difficult to find the genes for behavior because behavior is changing all the time. Behavior is really fluid. And the way you act, it depends not just on the genes you were born with, but the kind of childhood you had, who your parents were, what your siblings were like. So it's really tough finding the genes for behavior. And one of the things I'm most proud of in my professional career and that I talk about the whole story in my book, Dog is Love, is that we have actually been able to pin down three genes that mutated in the journey that certain wolves took to become dogs. On the journey from wolf to dog, there were three mutations, and we've been able to identify that those genetic mutations underpin this much greater propensity that dogs have compared to wolves and other wild animals to form friendships and bonds with members of other species. Oh, that's really exciting for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to explore that a little deeper with you when we come back on Self Talk Radio Show. We have Dr. Clive Wynn, the author of Dog is Love. Going to find out what's the big difference between dogs and wolves when we come back on Self Talk Radio Show. Can't sleep? Have brain fog? Try this. Sleep meditation, soothing meditations to help you stop bad habits, start positive change, and sleep like a baby. Sleepmeditation.org. Welcome back to Self Talk Radio Show. I'm Sarah Spencer with Dr. Clive Wynn, the author of Dog is Love. Now, you say there is a difference between dogs and wolves genetically.
And how, absolutely.
And how does that impact their behavior?
So, you know, the science of love, it's not rocket science. If you want to see how dogs love people, it doesn't take some kind of unbelievably complex, expensive piece of equipment. Here's our test. Okay, Sarah, here's our test. Anybody listening can try this for themselves. Get a chair. Mark around that chair a circle. Where scientists, we use metric, 1 meter radius. That's more or less 3 feet. A 3 foot radius circle around the chair. Separate yourself from your dog. Doesn't have to be very long. 10 minutes be plenty of time. Sit down in that chair and have somebody else let the dog into the room with you where you're seated in the chair. And now just watch. How much time does your dog choose to spend inside the circle with you? We give the animals just 2 minutes each. What we find is that if a dog has been separated from its special person, even for 10 minutes, that dog will spend pretty much the whole of those 2 minutes inside the circle. So long as you don't get a UPS delivery in the middle of doing this, that's what most people will find. Now, we go out to Wolf Park in Indiana. Wolf Park in Indiana, those are people who have been hand-rearing wolves since 1974. So nowhere in the world is there more expertise in how to raise wolves to accept people as companions, to be as friendly towards people as any wolf is ever going to get. And it's a beautiful place. People can visit it. It's out in Indiana. And we go out to Indiana and we repeat this study on the hand-reared wolves at Wolf Park in Indiana. The woman who sits in the chair for us is somebody who actually raised those wolves since they were tiny puppies. So they have a strong bond going back a long way. And the wolves like those people. They have a relationship, but they don't spend the whole of the 2 minutes inside the circle. They only spend about a quarter of the time, about 30 seconds inside the circle with their person. So here we have a super simple test that gives us a measure of the strength of the relationship between an animal and its person. And we immediately see that dogs have a much stronger interest in their people than even the most carefully hand-reared wolves. We do this study, we do it on a bunch of dogs, we do it on a bunch of wolves. Since then, we've actually been going off and collecting data on all sorts of other interesting animals. I was on vacation, I'm an Australian citizen, and I was on vacation in Australia 2 years ago, and I did this whole thing with a whole bunch of dingoes out in Australia, and we've done it with hand-reared coyotes, all sorts of animals.
Wow.
Anyway, we did it on the dogs and the wolves. Then we got DNA samples, which is just a mouth swab, completely painless, completely easy. We sent it to our friend Bridget von Holt, a geneticist at Princeton University, and she did the DNA for us. And that's how we found the genes that make dogs such loving beings, by comparing the behavior of the animals to the genetic material of the animals. And that's how we found the genes.
Wow. Now, I've also heard that foxes, there was someone who was, I can't remember the fella who was raising foxes, but he was saying that foxes are a lot more like cats than dogs, which I found interesting. Do you have any research to talk about foxes versus dogs? You do? Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think, Sarah, that you're hinting at this very famous, completely crazy experiment that was done in the Soviet Union, was done in Siberia. And it started in 1958. And the guy's name was Dmitry Belyaev. I'm not very good at pronouncing Russian, but that'll have to do. And he decided, foxes, like a lot of wild animals, they only breed once a year. Every year, he took the friendliest foxes and made them the parents of the next generation. So each year, he's selecting the friendliest foxes to form the next generation. And he kept doing this year after year after year, until by the time he died, which I think was 1975, so he'd been doing it for like 16, 17, 18 years, something like that, he had created this new tame animal, this fox, which is as friendly, in some ways even friendlier than the friendliest dog.
Wow.
But it remains the case that although they are very friendly, foxes are actually in the wild relatively solitary animals. So the nature of their friendliness, it is, I hadn't heard that before, but it does make sense to me that the nature of their friendliness is more like a cat, because cats are not in the wild as sociable as dogs are. You don't get cat packs or anything like that.
Right.
So yeah, that's true. They're the most beautiful animals. I've actually been out there to Siberia and seen them for myself. It was a heck of an experience, I tell you. It was amazing. Hundreds of these super friendly foxes.
Are they starting to make them into pets? And
they are
them?
Willing to sell them as pets, but they're not cheap, especially when you consider you have to, if you wanted one in the United States. I know some people in the United States. There's a wonderful organization in San Diego. They're open to the public, but I'm blocking on their name, unfortunately. They have a center in San Diego where members of the public can engage with these animals, and they have to be exported from Russia, from Siberia, which is pretty challenging at the best of times. And many states in the United States, it's not legal to keep foxes.
Yeah, because
legally vermin, so it's problematic.
Because I was wondering, you know, that's a slippery slope to go down, because if you do have fox loose, and especially if you're raising chickens and things like that, it can, you know, they can be quite a nuisance. So it's tough.
I love all these animals. I love going out to Wolf Park and meeting with the wolves, and I love the foxes. I love even hand-reared coyotes. You know, I love them all, but there's a reason why most of us have dogs as pets. Mm. Dogs are far, far better suited to living with us. It's not that you cannot form a relationship. I mean, lion tamer, that's a real thing. There are people who've formed relationships with lions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are all sorts of practical problems that come into your life if you are determined to try and keep a wild animal as a pet. And it's just not worth it. It's just not, I really don't think it's worth the aggravation.
Yeah. In your book, you also mentioned that dogs have a stronger social hierarchy than wolves. Now, how does that affect training dogs?
Well, so I'm glad you bring that up, Sarah, because it's a source of immense misunderstanding. Immense misunderstanding. In the book, I try and set people straight. So your dog is looking to you for leadership. Dogs have a strong ingrained understanding of hierarchy. All of that is true. Your dog looks to you for direction and guidance and leadership. What is a false belief, and a pernicious false belief, because it causes people to be cruel to their dogs and to make their lives with their dogs unnecessarily difficult, is to believe that because your dog expects you to be the leader, that that somehow means that your dog needs or expects you to be violent and cruel towards him or her. Your dog looks to you for leadership the way your youngest child, your infant, looks to a mother or father for guidance and leadership. You can and you should provide that leadership in the gentlest way possible. The idea that you shouldn't let your dog eat before you do, or that you shouldn't let your dog go through a doorway before you do, or that you need to beat and shock and hang your dog by its neck in order to convince your dog that you are the boss, that is all complete nonsense. For your dog to understand that you are the boss, you need to be the one who is in control. What does that mean? What does it mean to be in control of a dog's life? It means that you decide what, where, and when your dog eats. And you do that because you are the one with the opposable thumbs who can open the can of dog food, open the bag of dog kibble. You are the one who can do that. Your dog cannot do that. Your dog cannot open the fridge. It means that when your dog needs to carry out bathroom functions, that you are the one who decides where that happens. And your dog has to come and ask your permission to be able to do that. It means that when your dog wants to do some exercise, to go out for walk, I have to be careful.
I can see your dog right now just waiting.
She's sleeping in the background. But if I say certain words, she'll suddenly
perk up. It'll trigger, yeah.
So if you control your dog's life, and I think all of us do, that means you're in charge. And that means your dog looks to you for direction. That's all it means. It doesn't imply that you need to bring pain and coercion into your dog's life. There's no benefit to that. You can only make your relationship with your dog more complicated and more difficult if you start bringing pain into your dog's life.
We're speaking with Dr. Clive Wynn, the author of Dog is Love. And when we come back, I'm really fascinated about the discovery of the genes being close to those of people with Williams-Buren syndrome. And I want to talk a little bit more about that when we come back on Self-Talk Radio Show. Ready to create your own podcast? Not sure where to begin? Start with WebHelp US. They built Self-Talk Radio Show's site and the site for I Love Old Time Radio Show, now boasting over 100,000 downloads. Why not have them build yours? WebHelpUS.com. Welcome back to Self-Talk Radio Show. I'm Sarah Spencer, my guest, Dr. Clive Wynn. And it was mentioned that the research related to the discovery of genes being close to those with people who have Williams-Buren syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, absolutely, Sarah. So Williams-Buren syndrome is a very, very rare genetic problem that a tiny fraction of people have. It affects about 28 different genes. So it's a lot of genes, and it has a wide variety of impacts. People with Williams syndrome have strange facial structure. They have heart and circulatory problems. They have a whole bunch of things. But the really standout thing that strikes people about Williams syndrome is that people with Williams syndrome are unbelievably friendly. Children with Williams syndrome have no notion of stranger danger. You simply cannot convey that concept to them. It doesn't make any sense to them. I personally have never met somebody with Williams syndrome, but I've seen videos of them. And
wow.
And it's really quite amazing. Quite amazing.
Yeah.
Now,
I'm trying to wrap my head around someone who has that, you know, that joie de vivre of,
yeah,
you know,
well,
that trusting. Yeah.
It's quite wonderful, so long as they are in, of course, a loving environment. They are vulnerable to exploitation because of their trusting nature. But so long as they're kept in a loving family, a protective environment, it's almost an enviable state to be in. As I say, I've never seen them in real life, but I saw a video on YouTube of a journalist who went and visited a summer camp for kids with Williams syndrome. And I felt slightly embarrassed when I first saw this because, you know, there are also lots of very funny videos on YouTube of young people pretending to be dogs. And you know what? This video of the kids at the camp for Williams syndrome children, it looked like a whole summer camp of kids pretending to be dogs, which I was slightly ashamed when I had that feeling, because it doesn't seem, however much you love dogs, you don't want to compare people's children to dogs. It seems sort of shameful.
Wow.
So then I came across, I mentioned that we collaborated with a geneticist, Bridget von Holter, Princeton. And the reason why we collaborated with her is that she had already published a study where she had compared the DNA of dogs and wolves. She'd gone all the way through with her genetic machinery, and she had compared each gene, gene by gene by gene. And lots of it was really, really boring. But there was in there this tiny nugget that caught my attention. And it said, she said in there, that there's a change, there's a difference in the genetics of dogs and wolves in a part of the genes of dogs and wolves, which in people is involved in this Williams syndrome. And so I thought, well, that's curious. But Williams syndrome, it's 28 genes. She didn't know exactly which of the genes were involved. And so together with my collaborator, Monique Udell, now at Oregon State University, we got together with Bridget von Holt, and that's how we came to carry out our study. And when we gave Bridget the DNA samples from the dogs and the wolves, she went, made a beeline for that part of the genetic material, which, if these were humans, would be responsible for Williams syndrome. And the three genes that we found are all three of the 28 genes that are involved in Williams syndrome. And interestingly, they have already been identified by researchers studying Williams syndrome as they're not responsible for the funny facial structure, the heart deficits. These are genes that contribute to the super friendliness of people with Williams syndrome. So it all connects up. I was uncomfortable making a comparison between some people's children and our dogs. But I was pleased when we published this research, a journalist reached out to the president of the Williams Syndrome Parents Association of America. And he said, it makes perfect sense to me. He said, I always knew if our kids had tails, they'd be wagging them, which I thought was so sweet.
That's true. That's very true. You know, there's going to be some cynics, of course. I'm sure you've come up against them saying, hey, don't we already know that our dogs love us? Why study this? What's your answer to that?
My mother, for example.
Your parents are always your best critics, right?
Yeah, right. So my mother would say, oh, you know, it's not real love. It's just cupboard love, right? I think it's a British expression for meaning, you know, that they just love you for what they get out of you. It's not deep love. And so I think it's interesting. I think to those of us who love dogs and who ask ourselves whether our dogs really love us back, I think it's just interesting to know that what our dogs feel for us is definitely authentic love, insofar as it's ever possible to know of another being, right? I mean, people are entitled to be cynics. I mean, does your mother really love you? Does your husband, wife, son, daughter, you know, do they really love you? You're entitled to ask yourself those questions. But what I say to cynics is this, Sarah, if you can be convinced that any other living being loves you, mother, daughter, a wife, husband, if you can be convinced that any other living being loves you, then you ought to be convinced that your dog loves you. Because all of the measurements we could make on any other person that would convince us that they love somebody, the dog passes all of those tests. So that's one thing for me that I find very rich, and the people I talk to seem to resonate with that, is that you wonder what your dog's really thinking. Does your dog really love you? And I'm here to tell you that by and large, they do. And the other thing is that it has implications for how we live with dogs. I mean, there are 80 million dogs in the United States. There's like nearly half the population of the United States is living with dogs. And people want to know, how do I best live with my dog? And we've already touched on this a little bit, that there are misunderstandings out there that lead people to be cruel to their dogs when, if they understood better, they just wouldn't be. And the other practical implication that this has that I share with people is, well, so you bring a dog into your life because it's a wonderful thing to have such a friendly, sociable being in your life. And you want to give your dog the best life you can. You get the dog good dog food, and you give the dog good exercise, and so on. But there is a form of cruelty that people practice because they don't properly understand the nature of the dog. And that is that we often leave our dogs alone for far too long. We bring them into our lives because we love their friendly social nature, and we don't think what that implies when we walk away from them. And I worry that people, too many people, often through no fault of their own, are leaving their dogs alone while they go out all day to work and play. And the most common behavioral problem that people report in the United States is what people call separation anxiety, which I don't think is a great name for it, because it makes it sound like the dog has some kind of a disease or disorder, when really the problem is that what we're asking of our dogs is too much. Now, maybe not so much under the pandemic lockdown, but in a typical daily life of a person living in the United States, you leave for work at 7 or 8 in the morning. You don't come home till 6 or 7 in the evening. To leave a highly social animal alone for 10, 11 hours a day, I think that's cruel. And I've been trying to get people to recognize that we need to think about this. It may be that your life just simply makes it impossible for you to come home during the day. But there are alternatives. Dogs make friends very quickly. Maybe you have a neighbor who just likes to come around and watch TV with your dog. My dog loves watching TV with people. Or maybe a dog walker, or maybe a doggy daycare. There are things can be done. But if people don't recognize that this is the essential nature of the dog, and this is a need that the dog has that we must strive to fulfill, they won't do the right thing.
What if you introduce a second dog into the household? Does that help?
Absolutely. Of course, Sarah. So up until now in our conversation here, I've been repeatedly saying that dogs love people. They have a drive to love people. They want to love people. They need to love people. But that's a little bit of a shorthand. The truth is, dogs can love anything. Any being that they meet in the first 3 months of life, they will continue through the rest of life happy to make friends with members of those species. So, of course, every dog knows its own species, more or less. And so dogs can form friendships with other dogs, and that would save them from being lonely when they're left at home. You can, ranchers put dogs, puppies with their goats. I visited some goat ranches, but also sheep and goats are the most common worldwide. You put the puppies with the sheep or the goats when they're small, and they grow up into dogs who seek out goats for the kinds of strong emotional connections that we are accustomed to seeing them find with us. And that, of course, is very useful to the rancher. The dog stays with the goats. The particular ranchers I was visiting in Arizona, they worry about coyotes, and the dogs shoo away the coyotes. So dogs can, even cats, in principle, even their age-old enemies, cats, can be their friends, particularly if the kitten and the puppy meet when they're young enough, or meet the other species when they're young enough.
Doctor, thank you so much for being on the show. We've had Dr. Clive Wynn. He's the author of Dog is Love, and we'll have links to get the book and also more information on your work. What's coming up for you next?
Oh, well, we just this week published a study we've been working on for a long time, looking into whether dogs will actually rescue people from a box that a person seems to be trapped inside. So we're having some fun with that at the moment.
That is awesome. What a great job you have. You want to trade?
Oh, I do feel very privileged. I know how lucky I am, Sarah.
Dr. Clive Wynn, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'm Sarah Spencer for Self Talk Radio Show. If you're a fan of Self Talk Radio Show, head out to our Facebook page, take a picture of yourself listening to the show, and you could win yourself a $25 gift card courtesy of Pure Energy Apothecary or one of our guests or sponsors. Thank you so much for listening to Self Talk Radio Show, Mind Changing Radio, where you can find it on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and of course at selftalkradioshow.com.